ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Scummy Mummies podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. It's me, Helen Thorne.
And it's me, Ellie Gibson.
And guess what, Ellie? We've got a guest called Penny Windsor.
I could never have guessed.
I know,
she's unbelievable.
She's just in front of us.
All right, Penny.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Doing pretty good right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so where are we now? It's the September.
Yes.
The end of September. Is it still 2020?
I think so.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
We're still here. We're recording in London, and I think London had the highest rate of corona cases, or third highest, yesterday. So we're doing great, London. Well done, the government.
Yeah, basically, what we're saying, Penny, is if you cough, you're out. You can just get out.
That's okay? It. I mean, that's the rules of society now. It's like, banned if coughing.
Don't ruin our lives
for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
I've been threatening my children every morning. I don't want to hear a single cough from any of you.
No cough.
That's it. Just shut up.
That's the zeitgeist. So we've got Penny on the show today, Ellie. Well, A, because she's nice. B, she's very local.
What a lovely compliment. A, you're nice. Not you're interesting or clever or funny. You're just nice.
She said even yes.
Really, really great. Just nice. Yeah. Like a sort of decent biscuit, like a rich tea, not even a chocolate digestive.
Just like a bowl of spaghetti bolognese that's good. Anyway,
but not amazing. What's the end of that sentence? What's the end of that?
Everyone likes spaghetti bolognese.
I don't like being called spaghetti bolognese. It's my favourite.
I'm so sorry.
I heard there was an opening for a new presenter on Woman's Hour. Do you think I should apply?
Let me think. No! Okay.
Anyway, Penny Windsor has written an incredible book called Tender, The Imperfect Art of Caring. She's also an incredible photographer and a mother of two.
And, of course, she's nice. So.
And she's very
nice. She's got
nice.
That going for her.
So thank you, Penny, for coming on the show. And I was looking back at our back catalogue of podcasts, and I realised we haven't ever really talked about caring before, even though I'm sure 99% of our listeners are all carers in one capacity or another. And it's something that I've thought about, but we've never really dug deep.
Well, as you know, I don't care about anyone, so it's not something I really think
well,
about.
Well, let's do that next episode. Yeah, let's do about not caring. Yeah.
Let's care about no one.
Nihilism special. That'll be fun. Oh, what's beeping? What's going off?
Oh, that's my dishwasher.
Oh, right.
We're recording at my house, which we've only done a couple of times. The other time we've recorded at my house was with the lovely Andrea McLean, and she told us a lovely story about Michael Bublé wanking. So I'd go back and listen to that episode
as well. Yeah, that's true. That would probably be better than this one, to be honest. No offence, Penny.
I haven't got a Michael Bublé wanking anecdote.
Well, any wanking story is excellent.
We'll take anything. Yeah. Giving Rick Astley a handjob, something like that.
Oh, that would be such a good story, wouldn't
it? Yeah. Would he say, I'm never going to give you up? No, he won't. No, he doesn't say that when he's having sex.
I wonder if he would turn around and desert you after he climaxed. Well, perhaps we'll never know.
No.
Perhaps we will. Who knows?
I'll put it on my list.
This very serious podcast about this very serious subject that we care so much about.
That's right. Well, this is our natural way we go, because we're about to talk about something serious, so we go very silly and hysterical.
That's right. It's a coping mechanism,
Penny. And then we'll be serious. Okay, excellent. So, Penny, tell us about your family.
So my family here in London mm-hmm. is me and my two kids. My son Arthur's 10 and Agnes is 8, and Arthur is autistic and has learning difficulties. Mm-hmm. And the rest of my family are over in Australia.
So you had your children over here in England, away yeah. from your family, like me, and you became a single mum quite early on.
About 5 years ago. So the kids were 3 and 5. Mm-hmm. And their dad's still around, and he's with them every other weekend, but I'm their main carer. But that's not my only experience as a carer. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason I wrote the book about caring in general, rather than just being a parent to a disabled child, was because it's not the first time I've been a carer. I was a carer to my mum when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I think it's when I started putting all of those pieces together, when I had my son. It was funny, a few people have said, oh, when he was diagnosed, you must have been like, oh, I've kind of done this before, I can handle this. And I was like, actually, at first it was kind of the opposite, because I had looked after someone else before and I knew how hard it was. Mm. And so I think at first I was a bit overwhelmed, because this was my child now. So this is forever. Mm. You know, I'm going to be supporting him in some way or another forever. And so I think in some ways it was more overwhelming in the beginning. But then quite quickly I realized I'd learned so much from my experience with my mum, and that there were, even though the two things are really different, my mum had depression and she died by suicide when I was 22. Mm-hmm. And obviously they're really different situations, but at the same time, there was a lot they had in common. And in fact, actually, it was when I went back to Australia a couple of years ago, and I was catching up with a friend, and she's one of my oldest friends in the world, and we grew up on the same street together. Our parents knew each other really, really well, and her mum has Alzheimer's, and it was early onset, so it was diagnosed probably about 12 or 13 years ago. So she's coming to the end stages now, and we were just having a catch up. And talking about our days and our situations, couldn't stop laughing about how much there is in common between looking after a parent or a child if you're looking after someone that has a cognitive impairment. Mm-hmm. And so actually that's when I realised I'm just really interested in caring in general, because we sort of talk about, oh, parents over here looking after an autistic child or a child with Down syndrome or something like that. And then there's people looking after an elderly parent, or there's someone looking after Alzheimer's. I'm like, actually, we all have stuff in common. Mm. We all need a huge amount of support that we're not getting from the government and from society. And there's often this common problem of not really being able to speak about what's happening inside your house for lots of different reasons. And I just thought that's what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about caring, both on a personal level, but also on a political level as well.
So how old were you when you started looking after your mum then?
I was 11 when she started getting panic attacks and things like that. So it happened a bit gradually. So she was really well when I was young before then. And then, so between 11 and 13, she gradually got worse. And by the time I was about 13, she was in and out of hospital and, you know, in bed for weeks at a time. And just from then on, I just gradually took on more responsibility. But that's what's kind of interesting about it, because I didn't know the word carer when I was a teenager. I didn't know that's what I was doing. And in fact, I think I was probably like 30 by the time I even heard the word young carer. And I think, and it's interesting because I didn't really talk about my experiences at the time with anyone outside of the house, particularly. A few people knew what was going on. We did have a bit of support as a family, but I didn't really talk about it with friends. I didn't talk about it with openly with anyone. I don't think my teachers at school particularly knew, but I didn't have language to talk about it. And I think that's still a massive problem, even though we're much better at talking about depression and different mental illnesses now. I think particularly for the kids of people who have mental illnesses, it's really difficult for them to talk about. I think part of that's because it's not happening to you directly. It's happening to somebody else, but you are massively affected by what's happening. So like for me, I think, like a lot of people, I used to think being a carer was looking after someone who's dying,
yeah,
or, you know, washing them, feeding them,
and that physical
kind of
help. Yeah.
Physical
yeah.
help. And of course, lots of people do that kind of caring, but caring is so much broader than that. And it can be providing emotional, like a really huge amount of emotional support for somebody. It could be providing much more financial support. It could be just taking on extra responsibilities for them so they can conserve their energy for something else. Or it can be lots of different things. As a parent now, a lot of my caring responsibilities are having arguments with the local authority and, you know, going through quite, you know, extensive legal wrangles to get education right and things like that. That's as much a part of my experience as a carer as actually looking after my son is. And so it's kind of, caring is very broad, and I think we sometimes talk about it in very narrow terms. And so I think why that's problematic is that it can take a really long time for carers to self-identify as a carer. And so they can be taking on more and more responsibility over years and years and years and won't actually go to their GP or go to anyone else for help until they are falling apart and having their own burnout and having their own mental health problems because they can't cope with the responsibilities anymore. So I think talking about it it's important because I think when we can identify as carers earlier, we can then know to ask for help, and we can even like learn about what help there might be out there and get it before we fall apart, essentially.
A lot of people find that really hard, though, don't they, to ask for help. I think for a lot of people, it feels like exposing weakness or a sign of vulnerability. How do you kind of get over that?
Oh, it's so difficult. It's so difficult. And I think from like a parent's point of view, when you have a disabled child, I mean, I know that that was something I really, really struggled with. I'm like looking around me, seeing all of my friends coping with their two children and looking at my situation, particularly before my son was diagnosed, but even afterwards. Like, why can't I do it? Why is it so hard for us just to get out of the house and go to the park? And I know we all talk about how hard it is, but when you're talking about a family with an autistic child with learning difficulty, I mean, it's like kind of hard on another level.
Yeah.
And I would look at other people going, yeah, I know that's not easy for them, but it's still not what I'm experiencing.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the things that was really challenging in the beginning. Before he was diagnosed, if I was hanging out with my other friends who had children around the same time, especially by the time we had toddlers, I remember being like sitting around having coffee with them and they were going, oh, it's just finally getting a bit easier. And I just remember thinking, it's just getting harder for me. It's just getting harder. And I think whenever I would sort of say something that was happening in our house that was maybe not typical, but I didn't know, and then to have everybody kind of look back at you blank, like, don't know what you're talking about. That doesn't happen.
That is so hard.
It's really isolating. Mm. And I think whether you're a parent or you're looking after another family member, to have people look at you blankly and not know what you're talking about, it's so scary. And you sort of think, there must be something wrong with what I'm doing or how I am because everybody else has got this.
Yeah.
And I know none of us do anyway.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a slightly more extreme. It's almost just a bit more extreme. It's like, I just call parenting my son just like extreme parenting, really. It's not that different to being
quite like that, because that makes it sound
extreme parenting.
Yeah, it's almost like it's fun, like snowboarding off Mount Everest. Yes. I'm doing extreme parenting.
I mean, actually, some of it is really fun, because actually I've thrown a whole lot of shit out the window. I mean, a whole lot of shit.
Mm.
There is very early on, I were having conversations with other parents at school who were worrying about this and that, and piano lessons, and oh, do we do this? And I'm not sure whether to. I'm like, it's all fucking bullshit. You know that, right? I mean, I have a child that went to school who couldn't say a word, and he went into a mainstream school. I'm like, if you want to talk about worrying about your child is slightly behind in reading, like, I think the beauty of having your child that's on a completely different path is that you get to throw away comparison, you get to throw away everything. Like, there's no rule book, there is no kind of. So, even though, of course, I have lots of other worries, I don't worry about what I consider the small things. And it's had a spillover effect to my daughter as well, who's typical. She's not disabled. I don't worry that she doesn't know how to play the violin. She hasn't had a violin lesson. I don't have to worry about that. I don't feel like I'm not sitting there worrying, well, if she doesn't get into the best secondary school, what am I going to do? I'm like, she'll get into a good enough one.
Exactly.
And it'll be fine.
And I think maybe that's true of all parents as well. You have to let stuff go.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It winds me up. The country's obsession with handwriting, which comes from Michael Gove. And like, they're with the handwriting. I don't give a. They're all going to be bloody typing. Like, as humans,
they'll be thinking things and it'll be going onto the computer soon. Like, they literally don't even need hands in it.
No, exactly. They need to be able to fill out some forms.
Fingers will be worn down to little stumps that can operate mobile phones.
Right.
Microchips in our brains, it's pointless. But yeah, I think, and it will be different for every family and every child and every parent, but I think for me that's really helped is learning what to go, actually,
no.
Don't give a fuck about that.
Yeah, and if other people do that,
that's up to them. But yeah. I know,
and that's the thing, it's all individual. And I think as a family, in a way, that's been a massive gift. I mean, also, my son started in mainstream and he moved in year three to a specialist school. We happen to have the most amazing autistic school in our area. We're very, very lucky, and they've been incredible this year particularly. But, I mean, he could not be at a better school. He's at the most amazing school. And, you know, I still have people say to me, especially I think when they're just meeting me, they're trying to gauge what my son is like. Oh, does he go to mainstream or does he go to a special school? And I'm like, oh, he goes to a special school. And you can see people still have this idea that that's worse somehow.
Right.
People still think that going to a special school is a bad thing. Mm. And I'm like, are you kidding me? It's like, I mean, my daughter goes to a really good school, but also it's an amazing school. Mm. And he's lucky to be there. And we're incredibly lucky in this area that we have that school. But yeah, it's just we have, there's a lot of hang-ups about things like that. And and actually it's brilliant school and we're really, really lucky. He's at a school where he is accepted for who he is and he's amongst peers. Mm. In mainstream school, as much as they tried, and I do love them, it's where my daughter goes and it's a great school. But, you know, he was always being wedged into it. You know, it was like, oh, we're, I think a mainstream idea of inclusion often is just, of course, some kids just need small amounts of adaptation to make it work for them. In fact, most disabled kids just need some adaptations. But there are some kids for whom it's trying to force them to fit into a mainstream mold is just not going to be helpful for them. Mm. And it just, this idea that inclusion is always means the disabled person has to get closer to the non-disabled ideal, I think inherently is pretty ableist, actually. Like, I think accepting that he's just on a different path is much better for him. A lot of what I've experienced as being his parent is letting go of a lot of ideas that I had before that are just not true.
But that's so true about parenting in general, because you have these weird expectations about what your child is going to be and what you're going to be and what the whole path is going to be. But also you and I are both single parents. So we started off with a husband and thought this is the path we're going to have and we're going to share this together. And then one day that journey ends and you start a new journey, and it's about that. And we had, who do we have the other day on the podcast, Pippa Evans, saying you have to improvise your life, you have to just kind of go, oh well, this situation's come, what can I do with it, instead of hanging on to what you thought a family or a child or what was good or what was, you know, what you thought it was going to be about. That is hard.
It is hard. I mean, it's the key to enjoying your life. It's just learning how to let go of all of these expectations. And I think the thing is that we don't realise we have these expectations. Mm. A lot of them are unconscious. So we kind of go about our lives, do the things, and then when they don't meet our expectations, that's when we realise often that we've had these expectations. Mm. And I think the sooner we can acknowledge that all they are is expectations and that we aren't owed them. Mm. You know, no one's owed a non-disabled child. You know, disability is just a normal part of life. It's a very human experience that'll happen to lots of us. Mm. And I think accepting that that's just a part of being human is definitely the quickest way to kind of embracing your life. And I just sort of think if we fight against it, we just cause ourselves misery.
Mm. Mm.
It's not saying that, though. It doesn't mean it's easy.
No.
Because of these expectations are very deeply embedded and they come from our society. And I think that's really important to say. It's, you know, these are societal expectations as well. They're not just, I'm so selfish because I wanted everything to be perfect and I wanted, perfect children and whatever that is. It is, you know, we are very much told by society that that this is what you should want. And I think we do need to acknowledge that part of the reason why it's so difficult when your child gets a diagnosis is because society tells us it's bad. Mm. You know, society it makes life more difficult for my son. So whether or not, like day to day, there are difficulties that he has to, we all have to face and help, have to help him with, because some things that are really easy for some kids, he finds really, really hard. So it's not like it's easy. Being autistic and having learning difficulties is not easy. But also, you know, I really had to pick apart what it was that I was worried about, like what it was that I was scared of, what it was that made me sad about the idea that he was going to have to struggle so much. Yeah, so I think, part of it is disabled people are very hidden in our society, and particularly adults with learning difficulties. And I think, you know, what I was afraid of was that I kind of knew now that my son was in this group, this minority group that is very discriminated against. And when I could kind of clearly separate that out from my actual experience with my son, I could be like, right, I adore being a parent to my son, and he's lovely and he's teaching me all these great things, like, you know, letting shit go. But you know, there are things to be afraid of, and that is how badly he will probably be treated by society, and, you know, how hard I have to fight for him to get the right school and to, you know, have appropriate support and appropriate support for me so that I can keep being his carer long term. So there are reasons to be scared and worried, but it is important to separate them out from, you know, the person that you're supporting, if you know what I mean.
How important to that whole process of sort of accepting what is was getting a formal diagnosis? Like, was that a turning point, or was that just something you kind of knew was coming anyway?
Well, I think I started suspecting something was really up when he was two. He was behind. Between one and two, we could see he was falling more and more behind his peers, but I wasn't really worried at all. And then he got to about two, and that was when my daughter was born, and he reacted really badly to her birth. I couldn't ever put her down and not be right beside her, because he would either completely be unaware of her and just walk right over the top of her, or if she made a noise, he would just go and hit her or scratch her. Like, he just couldn't tolerate any noises she made. I couldn't have her in the room when I was trying to put him to bed, for instance, because he would just scream his head off if she made the tiniest little peep. So there were lots of indications that something, when he got to two, it wasn't just, oh, he's a bit behind. It's something else is going on, because he was incredibly anxious. And he started pulling his hair out and things like that when she came into the house. And so then I didn't think it was autism at first, because actually I have an autistic niece, and she was very what you would consider classically autistic. Like, she had all these very visible outward signs, no eye contact, always spinning and rocking, and all these sort of more, I guess, well-known traits, mm-hmm. And more visible. And my son didn't do those things. And in fact, actually, his eye contact isn't amazing, but his eye contact has always been great with me. And so I didn't notice he wasn't giving it to other people, for instance. And that's actually, again, quite common. And, you know, not unsurprising that you would give eye contact to someone you were really comfortable with, but not other people. So I wasn't sure if it was that at first, but I thought something was up. And then, so by the time he was about 2.5, and we actually moved to this area then, and then, so I got a referral then. By the time that all happened, I was pretty certain he was autistic. And so when we were talking about it with the pediatrician, I was like, yeah, we think he's autistic. Can we kind of get on with it? Let's get on with it. Because expecting that what would happen is we would be given some more support, that he would have some speech therapy and, you know, occupational therapies and different things. No, almost nothing. So we were all excited, got a diagnosis, brilliant, right, let's get cracking, and almost nothing. And that's not uncommon in this country to get virtually nothing.
I didn't know that, if I'm honest. I thought if that happens, then that someone would help you manage it or work on stuff.
No, not really. So he was 3 by the time he was officially diagnosed. He was in a preschool, and they were great and really helpful. But really, essentially what we needed to do was go through the education system to get the support he needed. The NHS did almost nothing. And that's quite typical of a developmental disorder. It's going to be different in every area. I think, you know, he couldn't speak at 3 at all. But not only couldn't he not speak, but he couldn't. His non-verbal communication was really terrible. So speech therapy is for all of that stuff, as well as for speech. And we got given 4 sessions.
4?
Yeah. And then 6 months later, we got given another 4.
I mean, there's television series that are longer. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. In fact, all television series I can think of have more episodes.
But you're basically, as a parent, expected to be their therapist. You're expected to be their care coordinator. So first of all, he was given the diagnosis, and then I didn't know what happened next. And basically, I was the one that had to research what happened next. Mm. I was expected to be his speech therapist, his occupational therapist, because, as a part of his diagnosis, he had an occupational therapy assessment. So that's all to do with movement, how you sequence your actions and your movements, and things like, you know, can you follow, like, can you copy what I'm doing, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and things like tying shoelaces and jumping and skipping and all those things. They wrote a 7-page report of all the things that he couldn't do that he should have been able to do at that age, and then they discharged us. Because there's no money in this borough for occupational therapy for autistic kids.
Wow.
So I knew he needed help, and there was none available.
And but you had the resources that you were able to do what you did. Well, I'm thinking about the parents who perhaps they're single parents with 3 other kids, and or they're working 2 jobs, or they don't have, you know.
I think, did I have the resources? I mean, I almost burnt myself out. And I would say I didn't even touch the sides of what he needed.
Right.
Then, especially in the world of autism, there's so much shit out there, and a lot of it is like completely charlatan. And you're somehow supposed to be able to decipher what's actually useful to your child and what's actually just highway robbery.
Mm.
And so even if you have resources, you could deplete, you could go bankrupt. We ended up paying actually for private occupational therapy, and I used his disability living allowance, which is sort of the government money, and I just filtered that directly in to private occupational therapy. And that was actually really effective. And we did that for like 2 years. I did that. It's really expensive. It was, you know, like £80 for a 45-minute session. Fuck. You know, it's really expensive.
So that's a weekly shot for some
families. Like more than for some family. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge amount of money. And I think it's really frustrating. We should never have had to do that.
Mm.
But I think especially when he was in preschool and we weren't getting the support we needed, it was the right thing to do with his disability allowance, because it did help me understand his sensory needs differently, and also what some of his behaviour was from. And so, you know, like really funny things I didn't understand at all, like why he would often move about a room and touch everything when we first arrived somewhere. And the occupational therapist was able to explain to me, oh, his proprioceptive sense is really off and he can't tell where he is in space. And so that's why he's moving and touching everything, because he needs to know where he is. And it's just things like that. It's like, oh, okay. Like to have someone watch your child and explain what some of the behavior means, like what it could mean.
Mm.
It was really, it was incredibly helpful. So I would say, like, if anyone asked me what was the best thing I ever did privately, occupational therapy is definitely one of the best things that we did. But, you know, we shouldn't have to do that. We should have that support. I mean, now he's at a specialist school. He gets more occupational therapy support through school, but it's not, I mean, it's not enough. Although now I have people to call, now I have people to talk to who know him, who observe him, all that kind of stuff, which is amazing. And that's one of the best things about him being in a special school, is that they just know what I'm talking about when I say I'm a bit concerned about this or so if anyone out there is worried about sending their child to a special school, do not worry, they're amazing.
And so with your, just getting back to your book, because you've obviously had an incredible experience both looking after your mother and your son, but in the book you speak to other carers, and what's your sort of broader understanding of caring as a whole? Because I know there'll be listeners who fit into all the categories that you have mentioned in your book.
Yeah, I mean, that was what I was so excited about doing the book, and it was one of the best bits about writing it, was speaking to all the different carers. So lots of people supporting a partner, and lots of people supporting parents, as well as children with life-limiting conditions, people with lifelong conditions, all different kinds of things. Obviously, this year has just been so incredibly challenging, and more, I think more so for carers and disabled people than anyone else. But the thing that's really interesting is that they're better suited to the challenges than anyone else, because they're already used to life throwing constant curveballs and having to be really flexible and having to change constantly and adjust to sort of a new thing and adjust to another new thing. I've learned so much from them all because they are all in really different situations. With, you know, my mum, she died, but we didn't know she was definitely going to die. And it's really interesting talking to carers who are looking after someone, and the only way that caring situation is going to end is when that person dies. And it's a really unique situation that we don't talk about a lot, which is the experience of grief before someone dies.
Yeah.
And it's a really real experience, and it's not something that we're that able to talk about. We always talk about grief in terms of the death itself, but grief is actually something we experience over all kinds of losses. I'm sure, as we all now know, this year, everyone's had losses this year of some kind or another, whether that's like, you know, loss of freedom or loss of income or, you know, not being able to see your parents or your siblings or whatever it is. Like losses of, I know for families like mine, losses of services. You know, we've spent years fighting for the services that we have, and we lost them all overnight. And it's the only way I think I could describe that is grief.
Mm.
And it's interesting, actually, because I wrote this book last year. It came out this year, but I wrote it last year. In lockdown, I did get in touch with quite a lot of the carers I spoke to see how they were all getting on. And lots of them said to me that the way they were feeling, it's like back in the days of an early diagnosis of the person that they look after, because it's like suddenly feeling like it's all been taken away again. Because I think it's sort of hard to explain, like if you've been fighting to get your child into school for 3 years or 4 years to get an appropriate school, to have that taken away, it's not the same as having your child's school taken away, that it's always been taken for granted that they would be there. You know, like you might have, I'd say the majority of my friends with autistic kids have had to go to court to get the support their child needs.
It's extraordinary. And it's really important you're talking about this, because I don't think I think parents who don't have autistic children would not know the battles that you have.
Yeah, I mean, you encounter. Have to become when you're a carer to someone who can't always necessarily advocate for themselves, whether that's a parent or a partner or a child, you have to become a legal expert, because no one else is going to do it. And no one's going to just give you anything. Mm. Unfortunately, sadly, you don't just get given things. You have to fight for it. And especially the last 10 years.
Mm. Yeah.
And so...
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a big fan of the Tories. Oh, you must be too. People.
You're always saying that, Ellie. Yeah, you're always saying
it. Love those guys. Great bunch of lads. They really care about
they
people.
They really care. Like they care
you
so
and your
much.
Son,
don't
yeah,
they
really yeah, care. Yeah, and the rest really of can. Us. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why they're known as the caring party.
Yes. And that's why you'll be voting for them again next time, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Any good can come from that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ellie. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So you've been a carer for how many years now?
Well, so, gosh, with my mum, yeah, good 10 years, I suppose.
And you were saying that she committed suicide 6 weeks after you moved to London, is that right? You just started a new life over here.
And then, yeah, so yeah. I had just finished uni and I knew I wanted to come and work here. So I came over fully expecting to, again, just be on the phone constantly with her and supporting her from afar, and then expecting that she would come spend stints maybe coming and staying with me here and I would go home. And then, yeah, she died 6 weeks after I got here.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was – it's sort of strange to say, but obviously it was a huge shock, but at the same time not a shock at all. Mm. And that's sort of hard to explain to people.
Yeah.
I think suicide in a way is a bit unique in that sense. But it's not like she had a prognosis and it was definitely going to happen. But at the same time, she had had quite a few suicide attempts that I knew that it was always knew that it was possible, that even though she had lots of periods, like she'd be fine again, well, not fine, she'd be quite well for a few months and then she would go downhill and she'd have a really bad few months. And it was sort of a kind of constant cycle. And so I got very accustomed to this cycle, and in a way it kind of lulled me into, oh, this is just how it is now.
Mm.
And so when she did die, in a way it was a shock, because I was a bit like, oh, no, but I thought this is what we were doing. You get unwell, you go into hospital, you get a lot better again, you have some good times, you get unwell again. And I was sort of used to that pattern. And so it was a huge shock in that sense. It was interesting, actually, because when she died, I was a bit like, ah, I've been feeling grief all these years.
Mm.
It was like I kind of was able to finally put a word to what I've been feeling. And I think for anyone who has a parent that has mental health problems and or a parent who has personality changes, like with dementia or Alzheimer's or something, I think a lot of what it is like a letting go, like a losses over time. Like you lose the person they were when they were raising you, and they are now still your parent, and you still adore them and you love them, but the relationship changes into something different. And so the grief happened for me over quite a long period of time, and in some ways that meant it was easier for me than, say, for instance, I know some of my friends who've had a sudden bereavement, and they've had to kind of do all of that at once.
Yeah.
So, so it's quite different in a way. But I think we're getting better about talking about death. Definitely. Slowly, I think we are getting better, but I don't think we talk about a lot of the nuances around grief sometimes. And I think we can be a bit ashamed about talking about our feelings of grief when the person's still alive. And then there's all these complications about, again, you know, when you're talking about a child who's not going to die, you know, do we have a right to use the word grief around a child who's not dying, who's very much there? You know, my son is well, he's not, you know, hopefully anything's not going to happen to him. But you know, there were some feelings of grief when he was diagnosed, but they weren't to do with him. They were to do with letting go of expectations that I had. And I think we do need to be careful about the way we talk about that, I think, particularly publicly, because I know that it can be very painful for autistic adults to hear parents talking about a sense of grief over their child's diagnosis. Because it is, you know, being autistic is just another way of being. It's a, you know, can be a lot more challenging, but it's part of them. Right. I know, and I can't separate my son from autism. It's completely impossible. Like, it would be like trying to separate my daughter from being a girl. I mean, it's like too integrated. I don't know. You couldn't separate them. My son's, the way he experiences everything is to do with how he processes the world. And so, yeah, you can't separate it out. So I'm not sad about him being autistic at all.
So to anyone listening who's perhaps just become a carer or is about to become a carer, is, you know, sort of at the beginning, what do you know now with all your years of experience that you kind of wish you'd known early on?
Well, I think it's really important to identify as a carer in a way, like recognise that what you're doing goes above and beyond being the grown-up child.
Or just being nice, which is, of course, we know you are.
Or like,
so glad, you know, I'm so glad I mentioned it at the beginning. I think it really put a framework of this whole podcast. Oh,
imagine if she was a nasty carer. That'd be awful. Sorry, yeah, so recognise that you are a carer.
Yeah, and a lot of people aren't that comfortable with the word. And I think recognising what you do goes above and beyond what the relationship would usually require of you. And I think the reason that's important is because you need to know when you're reaching your limit of what you can manage on your own. And I think it's very much a collective responsibility we have as a society to help support carers. But if we don't know, like if nobody knows what you're doing, if it's very hidden, it's very difficult for anyone else to help you. It might be really helpful to connect with other people who are doing a similar kind of caring that you're doing. And for instance, I spoke to lots of people in their 20s and 30s for the book, because often it's really difficult to find someone in that same point in your life doing something similar to you. It's not unusual in your 60s and 70s to be supporting a partner, but it is quite unusual in your 20s and 30s. And I know that a lot of people do feel quite isolated. I know one of the women I spoke to in the book said her husband, they're in their 30s, her husband had a brain hemorrhage, and she went at one point, you know, a year down the track or whatever, to a local support group, and, you know, all the other people there were in their 70s. Supporting a partner. And, you know, there was nothing that they could connect with and have in common. Their lives were just so different. I think, you know, that's where social media can be amazing, connecting with carers in your situation. And yeah, let people know around you what you're doing as and when you feel comfortable. It's not always easy, because often we want to protect the person we're supporting as well. That's the other thing as well. Often you're supporting someone who might have been your support before.
Yeah.
And so as you lose that support, and you're going to need to find it elsewhere as well. So I think if you're open enough with the people that you really, really trust about the kinds of things that are helpful, that can be a good start. But I would encourage people to offer and to offer specific help rather than say, I can do anything, tell me what to do. Because sometimes I think, particularly if you're in a new caring situation, well, it's just overwhelming, and sometimes you can't think of the right thing. But if you say, would it be helpful if I just take so-and-so to school tomorrow for you? You know, or would it be helpful if, or have you sorted out, especially with everything that's going on at the moment, a lot of people are without any kind of paid carer support. Some of them have it, but have less than they used to have, or they've had to change, or they've, you know, just offering. And then if they say, oh no, you know, no, that's not going to work, whatever, you know, don't be offended. It's probably just that it isn't very helpful in that situation. But keep offering, and just keep in touch with friends who are caring, because I think you can become physically very, very isolated when you're caring. It's one of the biggest problems with all the research that's been done. One of the biggest problems is isolation, and we all know what that's like now. But for, you know, for disabled people and carers, a lot of what's been happening this year is actually really normal for them, and it's happening all the time. And it might be because there's no access to respite, or it might be, you know, there could be lots of different reasons. But so if you can kind of imagine what we've all been through this year, and then for someone who's got a disabled family member, it might be a little bit like that all the time. Just keep in touch as well. I know, you know, we talk about that with, you know, when someone's got, you know, is going through a bout of depression or something, just sending their text message, reminding them they're there, don't expect them to come out, that kind of thing. And I think you need to treat caring in a similar kind of way, in that they might not want to talk about it with you, but they might just want to chat and hang out and know that people still are there. And, you know, for some people, this is not a very long time. It might just be, you know, a few years where they're supporting a parent or something. But for other people like me, this is lifelong, and it's really different to the intense kind of caring that some other people are doing, especially towards the end of life. But I think one of the challenges I have, like a lot of people who are going to be doing this long term, is sustaining my energy over a really, really long period of time. I think the thing that's I learnt most from my mum's experience was that she really regretted not looking after herself earlier, because I think things for her got very acute because she ignored her difficulties for quite a long time. And one of the really one of the upsides of me having cared for her is, and my mum being so open about what was happening with her, was that there's no mystery about particularly what happened with her, which is nice. I know for a lot of people, when you have a parent with mental health problems, it's very hidden from you when you're a child. So there's no mystery. I kind of know what happened. But one of the things that she always made me promise was that I wouldn't lose myself in motherhood. Like I wouldn't put myself last. And I think that's very much what she did. It's not the only thing that happened. It's not the only reason why, you know, things happened the way they happened. Of course, it's very complicated. But she very much thought that it was, that things would have been different if she had looked after herself. I think I had to think really, really carefully about how I was going to sustain myself. And I do that by making sure I'm always checking in with me and what I need. And obviously that this year has been really hard for that. But, you know, I have to think long term. I can't just think, oh, I've just got to get through until when they're at school, or, you know, when they're teenagers or whatever. You know, there is no end date for that. Arthur will change and grow, and he'll talk more, and he'll get skills, and he will continue to change and become more independent. But it's very unlikely he'll ever be independent fully. So I have to think about how I'm going to be able to be there for him permanently. And that means I really have to look after myself.
So what does that look like for you? How do you look after yourself?
For me, that's very much, I mean, work has been a big part of that, actually, because I love working. I'm really lucky. I have now two areas that I work in. I'm both a writer and photographer, and I love both of them. And I really enjoy the actual work, but also really like earning money. And I know that sounds really flippant and really stupid. Of course, everyone earns money. But, you know, most women, it's mostly women who give up paid work to do unpaid caring. More and more men are doing caring, but more women are giving up paid work to do it, and they're left without pensions. So there is a lifelong effect of giving up work to care for a disabled family member. I need alone time, and I get that's why this year has been really tricky. Alone time, definitely. I like to read a lot. I don't know, I know so many women who really struggle to do anything other than things for their family and paid work, and they don't let themselves do anything else, particularly if their children are at school or in paid childcare. I don't feel guilty at all about doing other things. I don't have to prove that what I'm doing is earning money or doing something productive in order for me to have it, because I know that the most important thing, other than just being able to obviously pay the mortgage and keep food on the table, the most important thing is that I'm well, because if I'm not well, everything's going to fall apart. And so if that means that I go for a big long walk at lunchtime when I could be being more productive and getting on with that thing that's due tomorrow, I just do it. And I don't spend a lot of time feeling guilty I just don't. I just have no time for that mum guilt bullshit. I just don't. And I think in a way, that's the privilege of watching my mum go through what she went through. Because I know that if I suffer, my kids will suffer, because that's what happened in our family. Mm. You know, when your parent can't cope, it's really terrible for their children. And I don't want my kids to go through that.
Yes.
Just look after yourselves, mums.
Yeah, just look after yourselves. And just
take some time out.
Oh, and just... Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Well, not whatever it is, not if it's heroin. Or
no, don't get into
Stay
crack.
Away from heroin.
Yeah, don't
God,
do that.
Please, no.
Well, I feel like we're all doing the best we can at any time. And I think especially this year, we're all just doing the best we can.
Yeah.
Your mum was doing the best she could, right? With the tools she had and the resources she had
absolutely.
And the equipment she had, she did the best she could.
She did the best she could. And, you know, a lot of what was going on was that, you know, it was the late 80s and into the 90s. And, you know, the support wasn't there. Appropriate no, support wasn't
talking,
there.
People weren't talking about it.
People weren't talking about it.
It was all hush-hush. It was all hidden away.
Yeah, very much. In fact, she said to me, she worked for a cancer organisation, and she said to me that she wished she had had cancer instead. She's like, people don't want to hear. They don't want to know. And they also think it's my fault that I'm ill. And I think we're slowly getting it better at that around mental illness. But I think, again, it's something that we talk about, but we're not necessarily putting into practice.
Oh, yeah, there's so much fucking awareness.
Yeah.
Awareness, yeah. Awareness, awareness. But, you know, whether there's the appropriate, you know, therapist for people.
Yeah, exactly. Whether the support is actually there.
There's many people who are fully aware they're mentally ill, they have a family member who's mentally ill, and they're fully aware they need support. And there's nothing, you can be aware all day long.
Yeah, so I think we just all need to, yeah, exactly. Lots of awareness, no support.
We're aware of the awareness. Yeah.
Well, right. Good. We've done, just to check, suicide, bereavement, depression... caring, autism. Should we have a Scummy Mummy confession?
Shall we do that?
Yeah, hooray! Now, Penny, do you have a Scummy Mummy confession you can share? God.
We sort of didn't do homeschooling.
Right.
Shall we say?
I think
lockdown.
About 99% of all mothers could say that as well, yes.
I'd Speak for yourself, we're up at 6 a.m. every day.
I know,
day.
You're the 1%, Ellie Gibson.
Yes, we read the Bible for 3 hours.
In Latin.
Then, yes, that's right. Then we'd construct a fort out of toilet rolls. No, we did.
But one thing I am quite proud of is that my daughter now knows all about percentages and how percentages work. And I can bet you guess why, because I'm pretty sure this happens in your family too.
What's that?
Adopt me. Eggs. She's learned all about.
What?
I don't know what this is. What is this?
She's learned all about how percentages work from Roblox, from Adopt Me.
Oh, Roblox.
Yeah.
Yes. So Matilda is into Roblox as well. I think, because I have an app that shows me how much she uses, I think she's on it about 3 to 4 hours a day playing this Adopt Me game, and it's all about animals and things like that. So see, it's fine.
That's our achievement of lockdown. It's been she's learned a bit of maths through Roblox.
Fair enough.
That's the level of parenting in lockdown that I did.
I think that's pretty strong where I'm standing. That's pretty good.
My Scummy Mummy confession is that I said to my children they can have packed lunches this year.
Why did you do that? That's your first mistake. Why
I know,
do
exactly.
That? Why?
Exactly. And I said, only if you'll make them.
Yeah, right.
Who's been making them, everybody? Fucking person.
Absolutely could not have predicted this chain of events. Absolutely. No one saw that coming. I'm not doing any self-care here, people.
Sometimes I lay out, like, the muesli bars, the yogurts/yogurts, the bread. Okay, make them. Just put the muesli bar into the box. Go on. Do it. Okay, fine, I'll do it.
What do you think would happen if you didn't do it?
I don't know, and I haven't found out.
Do you think they would starve to death?
I think they'd probably take bread and muesli bars.
I think they'd have 4 muesli bars.
Yeah,
I
just
know.
Saying.
Ellie,
let the fuckers starve. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, no, it's why my husband won't let us get a dog, because he always says, I always say, I'll walk it, me and the kids will walk it. And he's like, no, you won't. And I go,
you're right.
Yeah, you're right. No. Yeah, you're
anyway,
right.
Anyway, so that was my Scummy Mummy confession, is that I thought, yeah.
You thought wrong.
I did, again. And do you know what? I'll own that. I'm okay with being wrong.
Yeah, well,
because
what choice do you have? You're making the fucking fat lunches.
I often am wrong, but sometimes I'm right.
Yeah.
And... sometimes I'm nice, just like Penny Windsor.
Oh, what a lovely way to end. That's very nice. That's how nice you both are. There we go. So what's your book? Penny, plug your book.
Tender, The Imperfect Art of Caring. And it's wherever books are sold.
And it's a profoundly important book, says Clover Trapp. Sorry, I'll say that again. I can't even talk today. I think it's my eye. It's a profoundly...
Do you talk out of your eye?
Yeah, I do. In my third
you
eye.
You talk out of something and it ain't your mouth and it ain't your eye.
Oh, I'm so tired. It's a profoundly important book, says Clover Stroud, and I agree with her. So everyone should go and buy it. It's really important, and thank you for sharing your stories today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, thank you very much, Penny.
Thank you.
Until next time.
Bye-bye!
And I think, you know, part of it is very much that...
Penny, do carry on just making a very serious and moving point while Helen... What the fuck is that? Making it's that
every
noise now?
Every half an hour, my coffee machine cleans itself, Ellie. It's like a vagina. It's cleaning.
Oh, every half an hour? That's good for the environment.
No. It's after I've turned it on.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It turns itself off. So that's good for the environment because it's not using power anymore. Right. But it has to somehow like expunge
itself. It's not very good for my podcast, unfortunately.
Your podcast.
Yeah.
It is today.
It is today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.